February 8th, 2002. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. After closing up the bar she manages and going out drinking, 33-year-old Jamie Stickle drives back home to her apartment. Shortly thereafter, Jamie's Jeep Wrangler is found engulfed in flames near her front door, and her badly burned body is in the driver's seat. Even though some of Jamie's personal items are scattered on the ground, and there is a blood trail to suggest she was attacked, there is not enough concrete evidence to classify her death as a homicide. As a result, Jamie's cause of death is officially ruled to be undetermined, and the exact circumstances of how the fire started remain unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a case which can best be described as a true head-scratcher, the 2002 death of Jamie Stickle. I've received a few requests to cover this story, and while it's not particularly well known, I became intrigued by the case once I started delving into it. I've covered a number of unsolved mysteries on this podcast in which you can come up with a fairly concrete theory about what happened, but this is definitely not one of them. As you probably know, the case I featured on the very first episode of The Trail Went Cold was the unexplained death of Aileen Conway, who was found burned to death inside her flaming car, but there were so many odd details that it was impossible to figure out if she was the victim of foul play, or if the whole situation was nothing more than a tragic accident. This story is a bit similar, as we have a victim whose body was burned beyond recognition inside her Jeep, but while Aileen Conway's death appeared to involve a car crash, Jamie Stickle's vehicle just happened to catch on fire while she was parked outside her apartment. The most logical explanation is that someone committed an act of arson, but since investigators could not actually determine how this fire started, they were unable to conclude with 100% certainty that a homicide had taken place. But even if Jamie was murdered, it seems like no one has any clue who the perpetrator was or what their motive might have been. Once you look at all the evidence in this case, it's pretty difficult to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and come up with a theory which makes 100% complete sense, but I will try my very best on this episode. Also, after I'm done discussing Jamie's story, I'm going to briefly talk about another baffling cold case from Pittsburgh, the unsolved 1989 murder of 22-year-old Catherine Quirkery. Like Jamie, Catherine's body was burned beyond recognition, and it's one of the most harrowing crimes I've ever seen. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. And one more important announcement. Next month will be our podcast's 4-year anniversary, and we've currently got a poll featuring 10 of our most highly requested cold cases, and you can vote on which case you would like to see featured on our special anniversary episode. You can find the poll pinned to the top of our Facebook and Twitter pages, and it closes this coming Sunday, January the 19th, at midnight Eastern Standard Time. So be sure to cast your vote before then, and make it count. So with all that out of the way, let us now start exploring the unexplained death of Jamie Stickle. Our story begins in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 2002, and our central figure is 33-year-old Jamie Lynn Stickle. Jamie is a lesbian who originally hails from Uniontown, but decided to move to Pittsburgh in order to be with her girlfriend. They live together for a while in a rented apartment above a business called George Warhol of Scrap Metal, located on Chesbro Street in the city's North Side region. But only a few days before the events of this story took place, the couple went through a tumultuous breakup, and Jamie's girlfriend moved out. For the past 2 years, Jamie has managed a downtown bar named Sidekicks, located on Liberty Avenue. She is well-regarded by everyone who knows her, and known for being a prominent activist in the LGBTQ community, who is particularly gifted at raising money for various charitable causes, such as AIDS, breast cancer, and multiple sclerosis. At one point, Jamie took it upon herself to organize a benefit for the family of one of the bar's regular customers who had died of a heart attack at a young age, raising money to help them pay for a funeral and a tombstone. Shortly after midnight on February the 8th, Jamie completed her shift at Sidekicks and closed up the bar before leaving. For the next hour or so, she decided to go drinking at a nearby nightclub called Pegasus, which was known for catering to LGBTQ clientele. She then moved on to continue her drinking at another establishment called the Liberty Avenue Saloon and tried to enter the private after-hours club located upstairs. However, Jamie was denied admission because she had become too intoxicated by this point and reportedly got into an argument before she left. At approximately 2:45 a.m., Jamie went to a nearby parking lot and climbed into her Jeep Wrangler. Jamie's boss, the owner of the Sidekicks bar, just happened to pass by at this point and noticed that Jamie was having trouble backing out of the lot because her Jeep was stuck in a tight spot. After helping guide her into the street, he said goodbye to Jamie, and she drove off, but this would turn out to be the last time she was seen alive. At 3:47 a.m., the fire department received a report about a burning vehicle outside of George Walhalla Scrap Metal. When they arrived, they discovered that Jamie's Jeep Wrangler was parked only a few feet away from her apartment door and completely engulfed in flames. After first responders put the fire out, they noticed that there was a body in the Jeep's driver's seat, which had been burned beyond recognition, and the victim would soon be identified as Jamie. After an autopsy was performed, the coroner discovered the presence of smoke in Jamie's lungs, which meant that she was still alive at the time the fire started. On the surface, it appeared that Jamie might have been the victim of a violent attack, as a number of her personal items were found scattered on the ground near her apartment door, including her cell phone, cigarettes, lipstick, mace, some crumpled money, a partially eaten apple, and a small pink plastic flower. There were traces of blood and strands of hair found on the front door, as well as a blood trail from the apartment to the Jeep, and a small amount of blood was on the driver's side door handle. The keys to Jamie's apartment were found on the floor of the Jeep, and the front door was locked, suggesting that Jamie was attacked before she made it inside. However, Jamie's body was burned so badly that it was difficult to find any noticeable marks of trauma on her. They knew she wasn't shot or stabbed, but it was unclear how badly she may have been assaulted. A blood test showed that Jamie's blood alcohol content level at the time of her death was 0.25, while a urinalysis produced a result of 0.28. Since the legal limit in Pennsylvania is 0.08, this led to speculation that someone may have forced alcohol down Jamie's throat. But the chief toxicologist at the county coroner's office did not believe the scenario, as she likely would have not had that much alcohol in her urine if it had been forced into her body. There was also some question about whether Jamie entered the Jeep on her own accord, or if someone attacked her and dragged her body to the Jeep before setting it on fire. The police were a bit skeptical of this scenario, since Jamie was a heavy woman, and it would have been difficult for someone to place her body in the front seat in an upright position. The other big issue is that investigators were unable to figure out how exactly the fire started. While there was some evidence that an accelerant was used, it could not be determined what exactly the accelerant might have been. The case would be examined by insurance industry experts who had a history of analyzing vehicle fires, but they failed to come up with a reasonable explanation for what happened. They did conclude it was unlikely the fire was started inside the Jeep by something such as a drop cigarette, and suspected it had been ignited on the outside rear of the vehicle since the back tires were burned off. Police also sent the case to the office of legendary forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, who was Allegheny County coroner at the time, but even they were unable to come up with any answers. Wecht would state this was one of the few cases his office handled where they could determine how a victim died, but not why. Unfortunately, the heat of the fire was so intense that it completely destroyed any potential DNA evidence. There was also confusion about the keys found on the floor of the Jeep. Like I mentioned earlier, Jamie's apartment was located above a business named George Warhalla Scrap Metal, and George's wife, Maria Warhalla, was Jamie's landlady. Maria believed that the keys found inside the Jeep were a spare set she had given to Jamie on a previous occasion when she accidentally locked herself out. However, months later, Maria found the actual spare set of apartment keys while cleaning out her husband's office. In November of 2002, Maria was cleaning out Jamie's apartment when she came across a set of keys resting on top of the refrigerator, which were attached to a pink dog leash. According to Jamie's mother, Marge Walls, Jamie always liked to carry her work keys to the Sidekicks bar on a pink leash, so this seemed to suggest that Jamie did manage to go inside her apartment when she returned home on the night she was killed. But if so, why was the front door locked when the police arrived? Well, in spite of all these suspicious details, investigators ultimately concluded that there was not enough evidence to classify Jamie's death as a homicide, so the official ruling was that her death was undetermined. The problem was that Jamie did not have any known enemies, so if foul play actually took place, who could have been responsible? Of course, Jamie had just gone through a painful breakup with her longtime live-in girlfriend, who moved out of the apartment only days before Jamie's death. But police looked into the girlfriend, who had been staying with her parents, and was able to account for her whereabouts on the night Jamie was killed, so she was eliminated as a suspect. In spite of the breakup, Jamie had seemed upbeat during her final phone conversation with her mother, and was making plans to visit her in Uniontown that weekend, and those who saw Jamie during her final shift at Sidekicks said she was in a good mood. Even after interviewing many people, including members of the local LGBTQ community, investigators failed to uncover any promising suspects, and also could not find any evidence that Jamie may have been murdered because of her sexuality. In 2004, Marge Walls arranged to erect a billboard near the 16th Street Bridge, asking people to come forward if they had any information about Jamie's death. However, since the police never officially classified Jamie's death as a homicide, Marge was not allowed to use the word murdered on the billboard, and it failed to bring about any response. The LGBTQ community also launched a campaign to raise $18,000 for anyone who provided information about Jamie's case, but technically, they could not advertise the money as a reward, since her death had never officially been called a crime. Unfortunately, the investigation would remain at a complete standstill, and one medical examiner was quoted as saying, quote, "Once you rule a death undetermined, it tends to stay that way forever unless something new comes up. The best possible thing would be to turn up some new evidence," end quote. Well, in April of 2019, KDKA-TV, Pittsburgh's CBS affiliate, aired a story about Jamie's death, which featured an interview with Joe Myers, a former Pittsburgh homicide detective who had worked the case. Myers expressed his belief that the crime was a hired hit, stating, quote, "My personal theory is that there was someone within the gay community that Jamie had a problem with, and there were some, we'll call it outside or out of the area, people who were brought in to assault Jamie," end quote. While the police still consider Jamie Stickles' death to be an open case, it is currently inactive and remains unsolved after nearly 18 years. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Like I mentioned in the intro, this is one of the more head-scratching cases I've covered on the podcast in quite some time. But while I made some comparisons to the death of Aileen Conway, I believe there's far less ambiguity about whether or not foul play took place here. Even though Jamie's death is officially considered to be undetermined, you get the impression that virtually everyone who worked this case believed she was murdered, but since they lacked enough conclusive evidence to classify this as a homicide, they have stopped short of actually saying so. For example, Joe Myers, the aforementioned homicide detective who has since retired from the Pittsburgh police, is now openly expressing his belief that Jamie was the victim of some sort of professional hit, but I don't get the impression he ever shared this theory while he was still working the investigation. I'm going to state right up front that I definitely believe foul play took place here, even though I can't quite come up with a concrete theory to explain how everything played out. I think the main reason you have to believe Jamie was murdered is through the process of elimination, because I just don't see any logical way her death could have been an accident. I mean, in Aileen Conway's case, her vehicle caught fire after crashing into a guardrail, but Jamie's Jeep Wrangler somehow became engulfed in flames while it was parked and wound up burning her body beyond recognition. Short of Jamie being a victim of spontaneous combustion, how could something like this have happened if arson hadn't taken place? I mean, if you brainstorm hard enough, you can probably come up with other ways to explain it. Jamie was incredibly drunk when she died, with a blood alcohol content level which was over 3 times the legal limit, and quite frankly, she should not have been driving that night. If she somehow injured herself, that could account for the blood found at the scene, and since Jamie was a smoker, she could have conceivably had some sort of accident which started the fire, such as if she passed out in the front seat and dropped a lit cigarette. Or perhaps the Jeep Wrangler just had some faulty wiring or design flaw or random problem with the electrical system, which suddenly caused it to burst into flames, and the whole thing was just a freak accident. But this case was studied by multiple experts who investigate vehicle fires for a living, and they just could not come up with an explanation to account for how the Jeep might have caught fire on its own, and they don't believe it was the result of some sort of mishap with the cigarette. From the evidence they have to work with, they believe that the fire likely originated from the Jeep's rear, possibly near the fuel tank, and that an accelerant may have been used. Since Jamie was in the driver's seat, I don't see how this could have occurred unless the fire was deliberately set by someone else. This means that if someone did murder Jamie, they essentially committed the perfect crime, as they left so little evidence behind that police technically couldn't call it murder, even though they probably believed it was a murder. And no matter how hard they tried, they just could not turn up any promising suspects who had a motive to kill Jamie in such a brutal fashion. Remember, Jamie was technically still alive inside the Jeep while it was on fire, so we can only hope that she was not conscious at the time. Even though she didn't have any known enemies, Jamie was a very prominent activist in the LGBTQ community, so my first thought was that this might have been a hate crime. However, that angle didn't seem to lead anywhere, and now we have Joe Myers pushing forward a theory that someone within the gay community was responsible for Jamie's death, though he's not expanded upon why he thinks this. Myers stated that during his investigation into the local LGBTQ community, he found everyone to be so close-knit that they knew each other's business, yet none of them seemed to have any idea who might have killed Jamie. That's why he suspects the perpetrator or perpetrators might have been from out of town. Of course, I couldn't overlook the fact that Jamie just happened to go through a turbulent breakup with her longtime girlfriend on the very same week she was killed. There aren't any details out there about this ex-girlfriend or why the relationship came to an end, but police did investigate her and determined she was with her parents that night. It's interesting how during his KDKA TV interview, Myers stopped short of calling it an alibi, but said she was able to account for her whereabouts. Of course, if you believe the theory that this crime was a hired hit, then the ex-girlfriend having an alibi might not mean all that much, but they still decided to eliminate her as a suspect, and with so little information available about her, I'm going to stop short of accusing this woman of orchestrating a murder-for-hire plot. However, while it's interesting timing that Jamie was killed at her apartment so soon after her girlfriend moved out, you can look at the situation from an entirely different angle. Maybe there was someone else who had an obsession with Jamie and knew she was now living alone, which is why they chose to attack her at the apartment on this particular night. But even without a motive for this crime, it's difficult to figure out how this particular series of events might have played out. We know that after closing Sidekicks, the bar she managed, shortly after midnight, Jamie went out drinking at two other nightclubs and got so intoxicated that she was refused admission to a private after-hours club. She reportedly got into an argument over this situation before she left, so if Jamie made a scene, she could have captured the attention of someone who saw she was in a highly inebriated state and decided to take advantage of the situation and follow her home. I initially wondered if perhaps Jamie had picked up the person who harmed her and brought them back to her apartment, but Jamie's boss claims that he witnessed her exit the downtown parking lot in her Jeep before she drove home and that she was alone at the time. One of the strongest arguments for foul play was the fact that a blood trail was found between the Jeep and the apartment door, and a lot of Jamie's personal items were scattered on the ground. The most prevalent theory seems to be that Jamie was assaulted while she was attempting to enter her apartment, as there were traces of blood and hair on the front door. The killer then dragged Jamie's body to the Jeep before setting the vehicle on fire. But once again, she was heavily intoxicated at the time, so you can't completely rule out the possibility that she dropped those items on her own, and the blood could have been caused by her falling down and injuring herself. Since Jamie's body was so badly burned, it was impossible to determine what kind of injury she might have had. The police were initially skeptical of the theory that Jamie was placed upright in the driver's seat because she was a heavy woman, but I'm not sure I agree with that. From the photos I've seen of her, Jamie doesn't look that heavy, and if the hired hit theory is true, perhaps more than one person was involved. Since a small amount of blood was found on the driver's side door handle, I also wonder if Jamie attempted to flee while she was being attacked and open the door herself. She was then quickly incapacitated by her attacker after climbing into the Jeep before they started the fire. It is pretty odd that Jamie's apartment keys were found on the Jeep's floor, even though most of her other items were scattered outside. I've never seen any of the sources specify what happened to Jamie's vehicle keys, but it's possible they may have been on the same key ring. If so, then this would lend credence to the idea that Jamie pulled out the keys herself because she was planning to start the Jeep. The main reason it's suspected that Jamie was attacked before she entered her apartment is because the front door was found locked, but I still think it's possible she made it inside before this occurred, which adds an extra element of confusion to this case. Jamie was seen leaving the parking lot at around 2:45 a.m., and the call to the fire department occurred at 3:47. The drive from the downtown area to Jamie's apartment only takes around 5 minutes, so unless Jamie stopped somewhere else before she arrived home, that seems like an awful lot of time to have staged this crime. I know it's a small detail, but I find it interesting that one of the items found scattered on the ground was a partially eaten apple. Where exactly would Jamie have gotten this apple while out drinking in the wee hours of the morning? But if she had apples inside her apartment, then it makes more sense to me that she would have arrived home and started eating one before the attack took place. Of course, the one piece of evidence which throws everything for a loop is the fact that Jamie's work keys for the bar were found on top of her refrigerator, which strongly suggests she went inside at some point. I see no indication that investigators found any signs of violence in the apartment, so the logical explanation might be that someone compelled Jamie to open the front door before she was dragged or lured outside and assaulted. If so, then this might indicate that the perpetrator was someone Jamie knew or trusted, because how likely is it that she would open the door for a random stranger after 3 a.m.? But if this is what happened, I'm not sure why the front door was found locked. I suppose the perpetrator could have convinced Jamie to go somewhere with them, and after Jamie stepped outside and locked the door behind her, she was suddenly attacked. In online discussions about this case, One theory I've seen pushed forward is that after closing up the bar for the night, Jamie briefly drove back to the apartment to change clothes or something before she headed back downtown to go party at the other nightclub she frequented. This is when she could have placed her work keys on the fridge, and given that Jamie's apartment is only a 5-minute drive away, this theory is not implausible. But I guess it would depend on whether Jamie's whereabouts were completely accounted for from midnight until 2:45 a.m., and if she could be placed in the downtown area that entire time period. However, one detail I find very odd is that 9 whole months passed before Jamie's landlady, Maria Warhala, discovered the work keys on top of the fridge. Did the police just not bother to perform a thorough search of the apartment during that time period? As you might recall, Maria initially believed that the apartment keys found in the Jeep were a spare set she had given to Jamie after she accidentally locked herself out, but then Maria found the real spare set when cleaning out her husband George's office months later. During interviews, Maria said that Jamie had a very close relationship to both her and her husband. She would even do odd jobs for them, such as cleaning their house, and the Warhalas considered Jamie to be like a daughter to them. But I will say that George Warhala, who owns the scrap metal business where Jamie's apartment was located, is a pretty interesting character, as he happens to be the nephew of iconic artist Andy Warhol. Yes, that Andy Warhol. In October of 2013, George found himself in legal trouble and made the news after pleading guilty to obstructing a federal investigation into stolen nickel briquettes. 2 years earlier, George had told agents from the Department of Homeland Security that his business didn't handle nickel shipments, but that turned out to be a lie, as he had spent the past 5 years buying 80,000 pounds worth of stolen nickel briquettes from the operators of a warehouse in Baltimore before reselling them to a Pittsburgh scrap dealer at a profit. After pleading guilty, George was sentenced to 1 year's probation in order to pay over $148,000 in restitution. While this might be the only time our podcast ever explores a crime involving stolen nickel briquettes, while none of this stuff has anything to do with Jamie's case, it just adds another element of strangeness to the story, because when I started researching this, I certainly did not expect a connection to Andy Warhol. Now, I'm certainly not going to accuse George Warhala of being involved in Jamie's death, but if he was, it could answer some of these odd questions about the keys. Theoretically, if George had a thing for Jamie, he probably would have known that her girlfriend had just moved out after a breakup and Jamie was now living alone. Since the spare set of apartment keys were found in George's office, he could have let himself inside at any time, but if Jamie had such a close relationship with the Warhalas, she might have even been comfortable enough opening the door for George in the middle of the night. But like I said earlier, I don't want to accuse either of the Warhalas of anything, because I have to think they were thoroughly checked out by investigators. When there are so few logical explanations for what might have happened, you'll rack your brain trying to figure out anything. Another wild card is that we can't even be certain if sexual assault was a motive for this crime, as Jamie's body was burned so badly that it was impossible to tell if she was raped, and all potential DNA evidence was incinerated. Perhaps that is the main reason the Jeep was burned so thoroughly to begin with, but when you consider the fact that someone likely had to bring an accelerant with them to start the fire, this really seems like a very premeditated crime by someone who knew exactly what they were doing. Again, this does have the hallmarks of a hired hit, but why would someone like Jamie be targeted? Honestly, part of me wonders if Jamie might have been the victim of mistaken identity. I've already done a few episodes on unsolved cold cases, such as the murders of Matt Flores and Doug Johnston, where the crime resembled some sort of professional assassination, but since there was nothing in the victims' backgrounds to make them a likely target for murder, it was speculated that the killer got the wrong person by mistake. And of course, I also did an episode on the Mary Morris murders, where two victims with the same name from the same city were killed within 3 days of each other. Jamie's case is actually a bit reminiscent of the death of the first Mary Morris, as she was a woman with no known enemies, whose badly burned body was found inside her torched car, and the most prevalent theory is that she was killed because she was mistaken for the other Mary Morris. So could it be possible that Jamie Stickle was the victim of a hired hit, which was intended for someone else? Not to point the finger at George Warhol again, but he was involved in criminal activity years later, and Jamie's apartment was located above his business, so anything's possible. Of course, this is all just speculation on my part, but I don't believe the mistaken identity theory is any less plausible than the others. So now we're going to take a few moments to talk about another cold case from Pittsburgh, which probably has no real connection to Jamie's case, but has some interesting parallels. I sometimes see these two cases talked about in conjunction with each other, and they both had entire chapters devoted to them in a book about unsolved murders written by Jack Swint, titled Who Killed Pittsburgh, PA? This particular crime took place during the early morning hours of July the 22nd, 1989, and the victim was a 22-year-old woman named Catherine Corkery, who was only 5'1" and weighed only 100 pounds. At the time, Catherine lived in the Dormont borough of Pittsburgh, only about 5 or 6 miles away from where Jamie was killed, and she shared an apartment with her boyfriend. The couple went to a house party in the Mount Lebanon township, which was attended by more than 40 people, but Catherine's boyfriend went home before she did because he had to work early the next morning. Catherine was originally planning to walk home, but she got so intoxicated that her blood alcohol content level was 0.22. As a result, she told her friend she was going to get a ride. Catherine was gone from the party sometime after 2 a.m., but no one there could actually remember seeing her leave, and it was never confirmed if she got a ride with someone. Well, later that morning, Catherine's smoldering body was discovered under an apple tree in the backyard of a local residence. The location was only 2 blocks away from Catherine's apartment, and right next to the Pittsburgh Light Rail tracks, which she sometimes used as a shortcut when she walked home. Whoever killed Catherine had put a human leash around her neck and pulled her onto the train tracks, causing her to fall over and split her head open. After carrying her body into the backyard, the perpetrator proceeded to rape, choke, beat, and stab Catherine to death, and some slashes would be found on her breasts and groin. Some gasoline was then poured over Catherine's nude body before she was set on fire, which turned out to be so hot that it scorched the limbs of the apple tree. She was so badly burned that it took 16 hours to identify her by her fingerprints and dental records, and it was apparent that the killer had taken all of her clothing, including her shoes, with them when they left the scene. Catherine's boyfriend and virtually everyone else who attended the party that night were investigated and cleared as suspects, so much like Jamie Stickle's case, it seems like no one has any idea who could have been responsible for this crime. However, the aforementioned Who Killed Pittsburgh, PA? Book does present an interesting theory which points to a convicted murderer named Glenn Edward Rogers, who has been nicknamed the Cross Country Killer and the Casanova Killer. Rogers was sentenced to death for the murders of 2 separate women in both California and Florida, and is currently on death row at Florida's Union Correctional Institution. While these are the only 2 murders Rogers has officially been convicted of, he is suspected of killing many other people. At one point, Rogers claimed that his actual number of victims was close to 70, though he later recanted and said he was just joking. Believe it or not, Rogers has gained additional notoriety by being looked at as a possible alternate suspect in the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, though I wouldn't bet any money on that one. Anyway, during his chapter on Catherine Corkery's murder, Who Killed Pittsburgh, PA? Lists 7 similar unsolved murders which occurred between 1984 and 1991, in which female victims were brutally attacked and had their bodies set on fire. It explored the possibility that Rogers may have been responsible for all these crimes. Rogers was sent to an Ohio prison in 1987 for forgery and breaking and entering charges, before being released on June 1st, 1989, only a month and a half before Catherine was killed. While Rogers has never been linked to Catherine's death or any of the other seven murders, it's worth noting that all these crimes took place outside the time frame when he was incarcerated. However, Catherine's murder is the only one which took place in Pennsylvania, and I see no indication that Rogers can be placed there during that time period. I get the impression that the perpetrator may have been familiar with the Dormont area, since they chose to kill Catherine behind a house which had a pretty large backyard, which is probably why even though a fire was started, no one noticed Catherine's body till morning. Overall, Rogers' potential involvement is nothing more than pure speculation. All that being said, the manner in which Catherine was killed was incredibly brutal and sadistic, and I'm particularly creeped out by the detail of her being dragged around with a human leash. So you definitely get the impression this was not the perpetrator's first crime. Investigators never found any potential suspects in Catherine's personal life, and the level of sadism suggests that she may have had the misfortune of crossing paths with a full-fledged serial killer that night. Like I said, I seriously doubt that the same person who killed Catherine Corkery went on to kill Jamie Stickle, but since Catherine's murder has remained unsolved for over 30 years, I thought it wouldn't hurt to give this case some exposure on this episode. I am haunted by the fact that both these crimes involved the victim being set on fire. This means they had to be carrying some sort of accelerant with them at the time they decided to do this, so who knows what was going through their minds when they planned these murders out. While it's possible that Catherine was just in the wrong place at the wrong time and ran into the wrong person, Jamie was killed at her own apartment, so that indicates that someone was specifically targeting her. Since the perpetrator did such an effective job of not leaving any evidence behind, they either got incredibly lucky, or it may not have been the first crime of this nature they committed. That's one reason I do not find the theory about a hired hit to be implausible, because whoever was responsible seemed to know what they were doing. I know that Jamie's mother, Marge Walls, was left completely devastated by her daughter's murder, and still advocates for the case after all these years. I know of several unsolved cold cases in which it's very obvious who the perpetrator was, but there just isn't enough evidence for an arrest. While that must be incredibly frustrating for the victim's family, I can only imagine how much more frustrating and painful it must be for the families in cases like this, where no one seems to have any clue who did it or why. So if you happen to have any information on the unsolved death of Jamie Stickle, or if you know anything about the unsolved murder of Catherine Corkery, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we covered a story which was featured on the very first episode of Unsolved Mysteries involving a woman named Pat Mielbach and her attempts to find out if she was the biological daughter of automobile manufacturing pioneer John Francis Dodge. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Noel V, Deanna F, Michelle W, Just Katie, Lauren R, Kristen L, Sean B, Kristen K, and Lilo Z. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I want to play a trailer for a new podcast which just launched this week, where I'll be appearing as a guest on one of their future episodes. It's called My Passion Case, and each episode features a true crime podcaster talking about the one case they are most passionate about. If you know me well, you've probably already guessed which case I've chosen for my episode, but if not, you'll hear a brief snippet of me talking about it during this trailer. Have a listen.
This one stands out to me because I spoke with his father, I read his book, and I spent a good amount of time researching this case before I covered it, so it's set in pretty deep.
The West Memphis 3 case really got my head turning.
We're talking about the Silk Road website on the dark web.
On the dark web. The Silk Road with Dread Pirate Roberts. So welcome to my passion case, and thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, finally you talked to the real hero of the True Crime Garage duo, the captain. You're always talking to me.
So I would like to talk about the Long Island serial killer. I'm really excited to talk about this because I am usually that person, you know, at the bar, people are talking about something, and I'm like, oh, did you guys know that there's a serial killer at large, like down the street from us? And people usually have no idea.
The case that I'm going to discuss today is a lesser known case. This is a case from one of my old haunts, one of my old neighborhoods. And that's part of the reason why this became a passion case for me.
Looking, you know, as an adult, what case has completely captivated me and I have just dove on into, and that is the Lewis and Clark Valley serial killer.
Well, the Golden State Killer case, as it's come to be known, started out locally in the Sacramento area in the mid-70s as a series of unsolved rapes. And from there, it progressed through different areas of California and went down to Southern California, and the rapist became a full-fledged serial killer.
We're going to be discussing the controversial conviction of Tommy Ziegler, who has been on death row in Florida for the past 43 years for committing four murders in his furniture store on Christmas Eve in 1975 in the town of Winter Garden, Florida.
Thanks a lot for joining me, guys. We got Tim and Lance here from Missing Maura Murray.
And that becomes a bigger problem. So the chances of those being solved one day by that individual or other armchair detective individuals, slim to none. They'll be solved through like DNA or some kind of testing.
It also spurred my interest in true crime. They did a very famous episode on Jack the Ripper, which is a case that I think still fascinates most true crime aficionados to this day. And I think that got me very interested in the subject of true crime. And also, and as I shared with you offline, I live in suburban Cleveland now, but I grew up in the southeast side of Cleveland, around the 55th and Broadway area. And it just so happens one of the greatest unsolved cases in American history had a definite connection to that area, and it's the Cleveland Torso Murders.
I know a lot of people who, you know, have the impression that sex workers are, you know, out of it and, you know, they're druggies and blah, blah, blah. But like these women were very intuitive and very smart and very, you know, street savvy. And so to be able to make them feel comfortable when their job is to know in an instant who should I get in this car with or not, and every day know that their lives are at risk, that I think this person was certainly charming. Or at least, you know, had a pretty good offer for them, probably offering a lot of money.
I guess that's why I love this story, is because how far, I mean, there's all the black and white people of this world, and I'm not talking about race. I'm talking about people that are like, this is good, this is bad, you're good, you're bad, this is the law, this isn't the law, all that stuff. Their moral compass is set. But for the rest of us, how far do you go? How far do you allow this acceptance of this website? When do you draw the line that it's gone too far? And I think it's great that it forces people to question their own moral compass.
They see 100 abandoned vehicles with alcohol in them, and then the person goes away, sobers up and comes back, or goes to the hospital. It's very, very common. If you actually look at the police dispatch log, they kept all their eyes, as many eyes out there, as many eyes open that they had out there for her that night. And then they had to figure out, first of all, they had to figure out who she was, because the car wasn't registered in her name. And then they had to figure out how to contact her dad, and it takes time. And going back on it now, I'm 100% sure that all of the police involved would handle it differently.
Rape itself is usually an underreported crime, and we know of 50 rape victims. I know he's a suspect in a few other ones. But I just think there's other people that never came forward for whatever reason, shame, guilt, whatever. I think there's other victims out there. I don't know that there's dozens more out there, but I'd be surprised if there's not more. And as far as we know, he killed 13 people. I think that number could be higher too. And then you look at his home break-ins and burglaries. You know, those are in the hundreds.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶